don't you say something so I don't mind you here?
What? You bastard. He's disconnected. Are you connected? Well, how the hell are you? Pull your back.
Lecture S2, October 1st, 1962, Differential Calculus of Vector Fields. Lecture S2, October 1st, 1962, Differential Calculus of Vector Fields. Lecture S2, October 1st, 1962, Differential Calculus of Vector Fields.
As emphasized last time, at a facility in several points of view, the reason is that in any real situation, the situation is fairly complicated to analyze, say, in one example, it may be too complicated to analyze directly by solving the differential equations. But you can still get a very good idea of what the behavior of the system is going to be if you have some feel for the character of the solutions under different circumstances. Ideas such as the field lines, ideas such as lumped condensers and resistors, or rather capacitors, resistors and inductors and so forth, are very useful ones, and it's going to take up all of our time this first two terms to study these things so that we get a feel as to what should happen under different circumstances in electromagnetic situations. It is not possible to solve the Maxwell equations in all the circumstances exactly. And on the other hand, in presenting the subject of electricity and magnetism, none of the semi-physical models, such as field lines and so forth, are really adequate and accurate, precise, and simple, except the one abstract way of representing the laws, and that is by the differential equations. They have the advantage, therefore, of being fundamental, exact, as far as we know, and very precise. And there's nothing else to learn in the sense of something to unlearn if you've learned the differential equations. On the other hand, you will not be able to understand right away what should happen in different circumstances. You'll have to solve the equation. But it's much better to know something about the character of the solutions. And therefore, we must also study the ideas of field lines and other concepts which are made to help to understand the equations. That's the difference between the mathematics and physics. Mathematicians, or people who have a very mathematical mind, are often led astray in studying physics because they don't study the physics. They say, look, the Maxwell equations are all there is to electrodynamics. It's emitted by the physicist. Nothing else is contained. So since the equations, they look fairly complicated, but after all, they're only mathematical equations, and if I understand them mathematically inside out, I'll understand the physics inside out. It turns out to be a failure. Mathematicians who study physics this way, and there are many of them, make no contribution to physics, or very little, in fact, to mathematics. And the reason is that the actual physical situations in the real world are so complicated that it's necessary to have a much broader understanding of the equations. One must understand the equations, and that means, not in a mathematical sense, but understand in a definition given by Dirac. He said, I understand what an equation means. If I have a way of figuring out the characteristics of the solution without actually solving them, so if we have a way of knowing what should happen in a given circumstance without actually solving the equations, then we understand the equations under these circumstances. So a physical understanding is a completely unmathematical, imprecise, and inexact thing, but of absolute necessity for a physicist. Ordinarily, the course like this is given by slowly developing physical ideas, by starting with simple situations like Coulomb's law and going up into more and more complicated situations. This requires that you continuously forget things that you learned before, such, for example, that the electric field is the gradient of a potential, is true for a while, and then it disappears. And I prefer instead the reverse. It's the first to take the complete laws, and then to go backwards and take simple situations from them to develop the physical ideas that go with it. And that's what we're going to do. This is also completely against history, and it's often complained about physics course there should be in terms of the experiments by which the information was obtained. And of course, experiments require a certain history, You first do one experiment, you get one piece of information, you do another experiment, you get another piece of information, and by presenting all the information at the end, at the beginning, I don't not give you a feel for how the subject was developed. Because of our subject of physics has been developing for 200 years by some very ingenious people, and it's necessary to learn all this physics in a limited time, I'm sorry, but we have to lose something. And one thing that we have a tendency to lose in these lectures is the historical experimental development. It is hoped that in the laboratory some of this error is removed. Another possibility, if you're interested, is to read the Encyclopedia Britannica, which has excellent articles on many subjects of this kind, or other histories, or other textbooks in electricity and magnetism. Anyway, if you want to know some more, you can always find it out. Therefore, today I'm going to begin with the abstract mathematical end of the theory of electricity and magnetism. The ultimate idea is to explain the meaning of the Maxwell equations. And in doing so, we find they're written in a very peculiar notation with upside-down triangles and so on, and I have to explain what that is. And so I disregard completely the Maxwell equations and start to discuss the mathematics of vector fields. This will be of very great importance, not only for the Maxwell equations, but for all kinds of physical circumstances. You'll find the same things, the same writing, the same notation, again and again. Just like the ordinary differential calculus is so important in all kinds of physics, and integral calculus likewise, so the differentiation and of vectors is obviously an important matter. So I now turn to this subject. I've written on the one board here a few facts from the theory of vectors, the algebra of vectors, and partial derivatives, which I presume are known, and I wouldn't have, I just use them right off of here. You go back and learn them if you don't know them. Now, what's the problem? The first thing we're going to discuss is the simplest possible field, which is called a scalar field. By a field, you remember, we mean a number which depends upon positions in space. Of course, the number may change in time also, but that matter we don't have to worry about now. We'll talk about what it looks like at a given instant. Example, suppose we take a solid block of material which has been heated at one end and cooled at the other one, and someone's hit it with a hammer and so on. So there are various heats generated inside in different places, and so the temperature of the body varies from point to point in a complicated way. Then the temperature will be a function of x, y, and z, the position in space, in a three-dimensional system. So here's a position, a point in space, and the temperature varies as I move around, hotter here, cooler there. So what we mean by a scalar field is this, by a field merely something that varies in position in space, and by a scalar field that the thing which is varying in position in space is a scalar, and we have example of the temperature. Now we have another idea, which is a vector field, and I'll give an example of such a thing. And the idea is very simple. It's some vector. A vector, however, which is different in different places. As an example, you have a rotating body. Then the velocity is at any point of a piece of dirt in the body at a given instant is a vector. But it's a function of position. If I took the dirt somewhere else, it's going at a different speed. I'm going to take another example of a vector here. For our particular example with the block with temperature, and that's the heat flow in the block. If the block is here and the temperature, say, is high at this end and low at this end, cold and hot, then there'll be some flow of heat. The heat will run across the block. And I want to measure the flow. In certain places, the heat's flowing one way, in certain places, another way. So it's a directional thing, the direction of the heat flow. So the first aspect of the vector heat flow is going to be its direction, and its direction is in the direction of the flow of the heat. And its magnitude will measure how much heat is flowing, how fast it's flowing, but we have to make it more precise. We talk about how much is flowing per unit area. If we take an infinitesimal area here, at right angles to the direction of flow, and ask how much energy passes through that area per second, that's the length of the vector h. So the direction is equal to the direction of flow. This is only an example of a vector. It's not part of our general analysis. It's just to give an example of a vector. Its direction is a direction of flow, and its magnitude is equal to the heat flow, or the energy flow, the heat flow through a unit area, well, through an infinitesimal area, divided by that area. The heat, the flow per second. The heat that passes per second through here. The same vector can be defined in another way by looking at the components. The X component, let's try to find out how much heat would flow through an area which was not at right angles to the direction of the flow. Suppose that the heat is flowing in some direction indicated by a vector H. We know that the amount that flows through a unit area at right angles to the vector, the amount that flows through this area, is H per second times the area. But how much would we say flows if we took a different way of looking at it? Suppose we had an area, a surface this way at some angle. How much would flow per unit area through that surface? It's easy to see that all the heat that flows through the original thing flows through this. Flows through here. So that this heat flows through a bigger area. It's less per unit area. Another way of looking at it is reversed. If you took a unit area of this surface, you see that that doesn't cover, that the heat that flows through there flows through less of an area at right angles by the cosine of the angle between the two surfaces. And therefore, the amount of heat which flows through arbitrary surface when the heat flow is in this direction is H times the cosine of the angle between H and a direction at right angles to the surface. We will always use N for a vector of unit length at right angles to surfaces. We call the normal vector. And then we have a theme that thing here is this, that H dot N, or the component of H in the direction of N, is equal to the flow per unit area per second through a surface perpendicular to the normal N, or a surface who has a normal N. Well, that's the characteristics of the heat flow vector. I just wanted to illustrate an example of a vector in space. And now comes the central problem, which is the following. If we would like to describe the way these things vary in time, that's easy. We can differentiate with respect to time. But if we want to describe the relationship of the way the temperature is in one place to the way the temperature is in a nearby place, in other words, we start to think about the problem of differentiating the temperature with respect to position, because it differs in different places. So we start by analyzing the derivative of the temperature with respect to position. But we can differentiate the temperature with respect to X, or we could differentiate the temperature with respect to Y, and so on. Now you know that in order for physical laws to be useful, they must have the property, or well, we know that the physical laws often have the property that they do not depend upon the orientation of the coordinate system, and therefore they should be written in some form in which either both sides are scalars or both sides are vectors. Now, when I differentiate, say, I take the derivative of t with respect to x, the natural question is that a scalar or a vector, or what is it? Well, it's neither a scalar nor a vector, as you can easily appreciate, because if I took a new axis and the differentiated with respect to x, it would be certainly different than along the new axis. In fact, I have three possible derivatives right here with my own axes. And you say, three. So there are three kinds of derivatives, and always three numbers forms a vector. So these must be the components of a vector. Where x, y, and z are the dTx is the x component, dTy is the y component, dTdz is the z component. Now, it's not generally true that any three numbers form a vector. It's only true if, when I rotate the coordinate system, the components of the vector rotate among themselves in the correct way. So it's necessary to analyze how these things would change if I rotate the coordinate system. In order to prevent you from worrying too long, the answer is, yeah, it's a vector, all right, it's very simple. So if you now go to sleep while I demonstrate, in fact, that they rotate in the right manner, you don't have to worry about it, you just have to remember it, that's all. They form a vector, all right? The differentials do rotate when you rotate the coordinate system in the right way. Now, I had several ways to show it. The first way is the following. If we ask an independent of coordinate system question, we should get some information. Suppose that I take two points which separated from each other by some little interval, point one and point two, and they differ in position by x and the amount delta x, by y and the amount delta z, and in the other direction by the amount delta z. And I take the difference of the temperature at those two points. Now that difference for those two points is going to be the same no matter who measures it, provided those are the same two points. I mean, if you take a new coordinate system and use the same two points, you're going to get the same answer. So the difference of temperature is certainly the same no matter what coordinate system you use. Now, the difference in temperature is the temperature at the position x plus delta x, y plus delta y, and z plus delta z. Take away the temperature at the position x, y, z. And it's the most general characteristic kind of derivative that we can ask for. It's a derivative in a crazy direction, depending on the proportions of delta x, delta y, and delta z. But it's a general proposition of the partial differentiation business, which I'm assuming that we know, that this thing, in fact, this is a definition. Well, it depends. There's many ways of defining things. But this is one way of defining the derivatives. In the limiting case when delta t, delta x, delta y, and delta z are infinitesimal, of course, then or in first order, whichever way, well, all right, it's equal to this. Now, the delta x, delta y, and delta z are the components of a vector. If you consider the vector difference in position, let delta r be the vector between here and here. Of course, its components are delta x, delta y, and delta z. Now I have here a kind of combination, but I have an x component, a y component, a z component, times three numbers, which altogether make a scalar. You know from the theory of vector analysis that if you take a vector and another vector and multiply them together like this and take that combination, you do produce a scalar. It's possible to demonstrate this, that if you did produce a scalar by such a combination in which B was known to be a vector, then the three numbers A must be a vector, which is nice and natural. So let's suppose we've proved that some way. Then we conclude that these three numbers are a vector. Well, we need a notation for this glorious vector, and so I write down what the notation is that everyone has used. They make upside down triangle times T to represent that vector. This thing is called del, so sometimes you'd say it's del T, but people call this particular combination also grad T or gradient of T. It's a vector whose components are dt dx, dt dy, dt dz. So we have a general formula, for instance, that the difference of T of two infinitesimal points is equal to the component of gradient t dot, the difference in distance. And that's a definition also. That's an invariant definition. It shows that gradient t must be a vector. Now, I'd like to go a little further in analyzing this vector because it's rather important. And so I give what I would like to call another proof. But if you look into it very carefully, you'll see it's exactly the same proof, but in another form. Suppose I consider, I would like to show that this gradient t thing that I've talked about, this dt dx, dt dy, and dt dz, I'm going to show much more straightforwardly that if I calculate dt dx prime, dt dy prime, and dt dz prime in another coordinate system, that they differ from these by a certain linear combination, which is the right linear combination for a vector. So that's what I want to do this time. So I have a coordinate system x and y, and I have another crazy one at an angle, x prime, y prime, and I'm not going to worry about z. You can go home and do the case with three dimensions, but the idea is clear once you see how it works in two. For instance, we may have the relationship that x prime equals x cosine theta plus y sine theta, and that y prime equals minus x sine theta and y cosine theta. That incidentally implies that x is equal to x prime cosine theta minus y sine theta, and that y is equal to y prime, no, x prime sine theta plus y cosine theta. Prime. See, it's just the backwards of this. This is not very important what I'm doing. I'm just proving something. So now, at a given point here, which is x and y, I also have another pair of coordinates, x prime, y prime, which are related to x and y in one of these two manners. I will remind you, by the way, that a thing is or is not a vector, depending upon whether you can find AX primes, or that AX, for example, is AX prime times cosine theta minus AY prime sine theta, and so on. Analogous to these, if it's the same transformation, then these things transform the same as a line, and it can be represented by an arrow, and it's a vector. So our problem is to show that dt dx, when expressed in terms of dt dx prime and dt dy prime, obeys this combination. That's all. So I have to figure it out. That's all. So I see what happens when the guy tries to calculate dt dx. He takes a point here at x, and he takes another point here at x plus dx. And dt dx is the difference between the t at x at this minus. That's what I mean by delta x times dt dx. But suppose it's calculated by the other man. The other man doesn't find that only x prime is changed, but that y prime is changed also. You see, the other man would calculate the following for this. He would calculate t at x prime and y prime, that's this point, but he'd have to take that away from the x prime that belongs to this. If I substitute in this equation for the x prime that belongs to x plus delta x and y, I would put x plus delta x in here. Then you see I get the old x prime, just plus delta x times cosine theta. And the old y prime, I'm only changing the x, you see, minus delta x times sine theta. Now we have the difference between the t at this point and the t at that point, which is by the theory of the partial differentiations over here. ddx prime, because that's the variable that goes in here, of t multiplied by delta x cosine theta and dt dy prime multiplied by minus delta x sine theta. So here's our equation. It says that dt dx is equal to dt dx prime cosine theta, I'm canceling delta x, minus dt dy prime sine theta, which is just precisely the relationship that components of a vector have. All right? Anyway, it's a vector. That's all. And now, I'm going to do something that's extremely amusing, ingenious, and the characteristic that makes mathematics beautiful. The argument that this is a vector didn't depend upon what I was differentiating. What it told me is that no matter what I differentiate, if I write d dx equals d dx prime cosine theta minus sine theta d dy prime, and so on, the other equations, I didn't do the other two, which is d dy and so on, but they come out right, that this set of equations will be true no matter what it differentiates. As long as that's true, we don't write down what it differentiates. We let these things be written in the way Gene says, hungry for something to differentiate, but remaining hungry. And we consider it as an operation or an operator, which one of the operators is ddx, another operator is ddy, another operator is ddz. So if we imagine the following operation, operator, a new idea, a vector operator, or an operator with three components. An operator becomes three other operators when you turn the coordinate system. Three component operator. The three components are the x component of this operator is ddx, the y component of the operator is ddy, and the z component is ddz. In any other coordinate system, they rotate like a vector. So I can represent it with an arrow on the top with the standard rules about arrows, that when you rotate the coordinate system, you rotate the components in precisely the same manner as if it was an ordinary vector instead of being an operator. So we abstract the gradient away from the t. That's the brilliant idea. And with this brilliant idea understood, that it's just abstracted away, an enormous amount of correct equations can be immediately written down. And I'll explain how that works. First of all, this thing is an operator, and it is just as hungry as these. And so the thing all by itself doesn't mean anything. It's sometimes called del. And in general, it's written without the arrow, merely for technical reasons to save time, because there's no other meaning of the del. It's always a vector, and so you don't bother to remember that. But since this is your first time in, we'll always put the arrow on just so you can keep track of what's going to be vectors and what's not. Now, it by itself doesn't mean anything, but if I multiply it by a scalar, say t is a scalar, you can always multiply a vector by a scalar. It still doesn't mean anything, because if I translate it, it would be t ddx, which doesn't mean anything. It's still an operator or something. However, with the algebra of vectors, we can have AA would be a vector, but we can also multiply on the other side. And so in ordinary algebra, this quantity and this quantity are equal, of course. But we have to remember one thing about this operator business that's just a little bit different than the ordinary rules with the vectors is that you want to get the order right so that the thing makes sense. In other words, this doesn't make any sense, but this makes sense, and it's equal. If it were algebra, it would be equal, so this is what it is, what you'll want it to be. It's just a convention. We've got a confusion of two conventions. One is the convention that when we write a derivative, we always put what we differentiate to the right, and so we have a certain strain always to write the things in the correct order. But aside from that minor matter, there's no troubles. In fact, I find that that's such an annoyance that it's very convenient often to give an arrow to tell what it's supposed to differentiate. And of course, when you publish your paper, you rearrange the order so it does it right, and then just write the final equations down. But never mind this problem of order. We understand that if we multiply a vector by a scalar, we get a vector. And this is no longer a hungry operator, but a completely satisfied operator, and is a physical vector. And it has a definite sense, because we've already discussed the sense of it. It represents the rate of change of t. It represents this, that if t is changing from point to point, the component of this in the x direction is how far t changes when you move in the x direction. And what is the direction of grad t, incidentally? Inasmuch as the change in t in any direction, it's missing because it's erased, but the change in t in any direction is the component of the gradient in that direction. You remember if we multiply by delta on a given direction, we got the change. Since the rate of change of t, if you move in any direction, is the component of grad t in that direction, of course, if we get exactly in the direction of grad t itself, we get the maximum component. So the direction of gradient t is the direction in which t changes fastest. In other words, if this is a point in space, and you look around yourself to the place where in a given distance, where the t is the furthest away from this, higher, then this is the direction of the vector of grad t. And its components represent the three derivatives. That's all entertaining enough, but now let's see if this business of abstracting the operator away from the vector will automatically produce for us physical sense other things. For other things. I shouldn't have erased that. That's very important. Well, it's easy enough to combine it with a scalar. Let's try combining it with a vector. We discussed a particular vector, which is a flow vector. There's 1,000 other vectors, the electric field in space, the velocity of a rotating object in different places inside the object, the speed of water flow inside of a tank that's sloshing around, and so on and so on. Now, this is of any vector at all. Now, this is also an operation. How can we combine the two so as to make things which are either vectors or scalars. In the same manner as we do in the algebra, we can combine two vectors to produce a scalar. So we can combine these two quantities to produce a scalar by putting a dot between. But again, one of them doesn't make sense, the other one does, because of the convention that the differentiations must appear in front of the thing that it differentiates. And so consider, therefore, the following dot product. Dot between two vectors, that must be a scalar. And what in the devil would it mean? Well, it means the following. If A dot B is a scalar, we know that in component form, it's the X component of A times the X component of H. You know, the X component of the grad times the X component of H plus the Y component, and so on. But what is this X component of the gradient? It's the operation d dx. So this thing is dh x dx plus dh y dy plus dh z dz. And this combination of things is invariant under coordinate transformations. It's the same in every coordinate system. It doesn't look the same. dhx prime, dx prime, dy prime, and so on. Doesn't look like it's equal to that, but it is equal to that. How do I know? I just proved that these ddx's transform with the cosines, and you know that the h's transform with the cosines. So if you multiply the two together, all the cosines and sines and so on will combine in the same way as they would algebraically, and thus produce, as we proved in the algebraic case, a scalar because of something. And that is that the cosines which appear in front of the h's here and behind the ddx's can come out in front of the ddx's because they're constants. That's an important point. So therefore, the algebra is exactly the same, and we proved that this is a scalar. See, our problem is in the math and the physics. To find out when we want to differentiate things, we'll never find an equation that looks like this. dh dx with respect to y is equal to the heat, is equal to q, or some kind of a physical equation like this. Because if someone else uses a different coordinate system, and if q is a scalar, a quantity that's the same in both, this thing won't mean anything. It'll be different in a different system. So our problem is really to find out what combination of derivatives has physically important sense, a geometrically important sense. And here's one. This combination is the same in every coordinate system. This particular combination, therefore, is an important one in physics, appears all the time, and it's called the divergence. Or it's unfortunate, or maybe it's not unfortunate, it's handy in a way. It's not necessary. One could call this del dot H, and many people do. It's also called the divergence. So if you don't mind, we'll have to learn a few words to go with the things too. This kind of a thing is called the gradient. This is called the divergence of a vector A. Since it has the same in all coordinate systems, since this is the same in all coordinate systems, it must have some interesting physical definition that's independent of the coordinate system. Just like I defined the vector gradient without the coordinate system by saying it's the rate of change of t in the direction in which t changes fastest. That's an absolute definition without coordinates. And I will have to find for you later a definition, a physical definition of what this is. But in the meantime, we just look at it formally and continue with this amazing game of cooking things up by supposing that this is a vector and that this is two. Well, the obvious other combination of these two things that we can form in order to form a vector, combine two vectors, is to combine two as the cross product, and this produces a vector. And sure enough, it's a vector, all right. But what does it mean in a sense? How do I define it? I can define it by telling you what the three components are. The curl of H, or this rather, this del cross H, has components. The Z component is equal to d dx of h sub y minus d dy of h sub x. Now, where does that come from? It comes from this. The z component of a cross product of any two vectors is a sub x b sub y minus a sub y b sub x. So the two stages in which I would obtain this would be, I'd say, all right, this is just a vector. Then it would say, like the a over there, and it says a sub x times b. B is the h in this formula. B sub y minus a sub y b sub x. And now I just remember that this isn't really, honest to goodness, an algebraic vector, but it's a grand vector operator, that the x component of the gradient is ddx, that the y component is ddy, and that the z component is ddz. And so by following the algebraic rules, learning nothing new, in other words, I get the correct formula for the for this combination del cross A. This combination happens to be called the curl of A. The reason for the names and the physical meaning of the combination will be discussed later. Of course, in the same manner, we can find the y component. The y component of A cross B starts like this, yz. It says dz component times hx minus hx component times hz, and therefore is ddz of hx minus ddx of hz. And this combination is a component, the y component, of a vector, and will transform as a vector and so on. So that's how it's done. You merely put the things together, and it works for the reason outlined. So we have these two combinations of first derivatives on a vector. On a scalar, the only thing we can make is the gradient. On a vector, we have two things we can make. That's all there is to it. I have only to tell, I mean, that's when we can expect now at this level that the fundamental equations of physics, which when they're not referring to coordinate systems, will involve only combinations of divergences and curls and gradients. And I've written as an example the equations, just to show you what they look like, the Maxwell equations of Maxwell, which we're going to study all during this year. But you see that they are of the form advertised, that there's a divergence, there's a formula that tells you what the divergence of E is. It's equal to rho over epsilon zero. Rho is the charge per unit volume. In these equations, we've assumed not that the electrons are point charges, but that we're so on such a large scale that we can describe the average density of the charge. Or if you wish, if you want to describe electrons, we'll suppose electrons have a density over a very small sphere, and we take the limit of infinitesimal sphere so that there really is a charge density. When the electrons move, there's a flow of electricity or a current flow. And then there's a formula for the divergence, for the curl and so on of E and B, all interrelated. So you see the physics equations involve just this symbol. And you can translate all those equations into components if you wish to find out what they mean in components. Well, let me give another example of a law of physics written in vector notation. This law is not a precise one, but it is true that for many metals or a lot of other substances that conduct heat, the following is so, that if you take that the material is uniform and you take two surfaces and you heat one to temperature T1 and the other to temperature T2 that's different, let's say T2 is cooler than T1, then heat will flow through here. And the heat that flows is equal to, this year we have new chalk, is equal to the area, is proportional to the area. Of course, the bigger the area of the plates, the more that flows, the area times the temperature difference. No, not quite, divided by the distance between the plates. If the plates are closer together and you have 5 degrees across two plates that are this far apart, it flows easy. If it's this far apart, more heat flows in proportion inversely as the distance, more as the difference in temperature over the distance. So this is the law of the heat flow. Or the heat that flows per unit area is equal to this difference. Now what will happen in a more general circumstance in which we have a block, which has temperature variations all over it. The temperature is varying all over and the heat's flowing in all directions. If I take an infinitesimal area right across the heat flow here, and if this block is made of a substance, I'm sorry, there's a mistake. It's proportional to this. There's a constant of proportionality, which is depends on the substance. So kappa is called the heat conductivity, and it's proportional to the substance. So in this circumstance, what happens? If we consider two tiny planes, infinitesimal in area, very close together, then we know in that little region it looks just like this. And in that little region, this law is right. What is the heat flow per unit area? That's H. That's what I call the heat flow. And what is the difference in temperature divided by the distance between the plates? That's just the derivative of the temperature with respect to distance. And so we find that H is equal to a constant times the rate of change of the temperature. Now I've drawn the two plates in a direction of the maximum difference in temperature. That's the direction that the heat flows. And so the direction that the heat flows is in a direction of the maximum rate of change of temperature. So this law becomes this one with some error. It's a minus sign. After you think about it a while, you'll see that if the temperature rises in this direction, if that's the direction which gradient, the derivative is positive, the heat flows the opposite way, of course. So here is the law of heat conductivity, heat conduction in a material, in some materials, most materials. So there's another example. And you see, it's a perfectly satisfactory equation. T is a scalar. The operator turns it in, the gradient turns it into a vector. This is a constant, so it's still a vector. And on the other side, I have the heat flow, which is a vector. So it's a perfectly okay equation, and it's typical of all of the physics equations. Now, however, the next thing I'd like to talk about before I explain a physical meaning to the various terms in the divergence and the curl. Oh, incidentally, you may amuse yourself now by showing, by calculating what the curl of H is if H equals this and if kappa is constant. Hint, the answer is zero. Try and see. Now, before I go into explaining this that much, I would like to... I'm always playing games with the blackboard. I'd like to go to the second derivatives just for the hell of it, you see, just to make fun. Suppose we go to another derivative of this. In fact, I'd given away what I was just about to do. Suppose first we take, we have a vector here. Suppose that we ask for new things, like the curl of the gradient of T. That's, you go to the next derivative, and you can always make it hard for yourself. But look here, we have grad cross grad T. T is a scalar, and these are two vectors. And they're the same vector because they're the same operation, d dx, you know, and so on. It's the same operation. So if you look here, you know that A cross A, the parentheses has nothing to do with it. If you had vectors here, you'd write A cross AA, where that's a scalar. And that's, of course, the same as A cross A times a scalar. And A cross A is zero. And therefore, this is zero. That's true. And if you substitute from all these definitions of the curl, let me do it once to show you. Let's take the z component of this thing, just to see if we understand it. If we take the z component is the rate of change, it says here, with respect to x, of the y component of gradient t. Take away the y derivative of the x component of gradient t. Now let's see, what was the y component of gradient t? Oh yes, the gradient, the y component is just dt dy. And here we have dy times dt dx. And that's something else I hope that you would remember from partial derivatives, that it doesn't make any difference in which order you take the partial derivatives, and therefore this and this are equal and cancel. So the curl is in fact zero, as you would guess by just saying, never mind anything, I'll just assume that this thing behaves like a vector. Now I take another one. Let's see if we can find another zero up there. Yeah, there's a nice one. A dot, you see the dot product between a cross product, which contains one of them, anyway, it's zero. A dot A cross B, because A cross B is perpendicular A. And then the component in the direction A is zero. So we can write that the divergence of the curl of H is equal to zero. That because of this equation A dot A cross B, which I use for A gradient and I use for B, H. And I let you try to prove this by substitution. It's true. It always works. They all work. They have to work. Now, I'm going to tell you something that I'm not proving at this point. And we'll leave either for the mathematics department to prove, or maybe I can find a proof in time. At any rate, it's interesting and very useful for physicists to know the following. Since the curl of a gradient is zero, it's very often sometimes in a problem you find that the curl of some quantity, say A, is zero. Now you know that the curl of a gradient is zero. It's easy to remember from the way the vectors work, if you just know the vector algebra, so you can remember this. So you might think one possibility is that A is the gradient of something, because if A is the gradient of something, its curl will be zero. Well, the point is that you can prove that if the curl A is zero, then it is true that A is a gradient. That A is a gradient. Then A is equal to gradient of something. There exists a psi such that A equals grad psi. In other words, this kind of an equation has a solution just by this identity. These are identities. And in the same manner, if the divergence of A is zero, you know the divergence of the curl of something is always zero. And it turns out that if you find a vector whose divergence is zero, then you can conclude that the vector is in fact the curl of some vector, C. It always can be written some curl of something. These I did not prove here, but I would only write them down to be remembered when you remember these. Well, those were two that were zero, and now I got to find some that are not zero. The other thing that I can make with two things is to take the divergence of the gradient. That's not zero. But you see mathematically that that's the same as grad dot grad times t. And grad dot grad is an interesting combination because it's ddx times ddx plus ddy times ddy plus ddz times ddz. And this is ddx square plus ddy square. It's a square of the gradient, you see. And is written several different ways, sometimes as the square of the gradient times t. And this particular combination, the square of the gradient, also has a name. That's one of the troubles with this world. You have so many names to learn. It's called the Laplacian. But it's just the square of the gradient. But they don't get anywhere from that. I just tell you what the divergence of the gradient is. Now we have one more possibility. If you figure out all the possibilities, there's only one more, and that's the curl of the curl. Now, this curl of the curl can be reduced, or changed at least, by use of this formula here. Here's a curl, cross product, you write it this way. In order to use that formula, I write, capital A is curl, is a gradient operation. B is another gradient operation, C equal H. So I translate, here's the gradient, that's the B one, all right? And then comes the A one, and then comes the H. Now over here comes the C, well that's the H, and then comes the A and the B. Good, I got a wonderful law, new law. Yeah. Well, does it make sense? Here's a curl, all right? I mean, it's a vector, all right? It's a vector, yeah. But here is a scalar, and the gradient of a scalar, that's a vector, that's all right. And here's a, well, this is a dopiness, because here, these things don't differentiate anything. Yeah, you have to work on something. But this del dot del is a scalar, and you can put it either behind or in front of the vector. You see, algebraically, this quantity here could just as well have been written as A dot B times C. In fact, it's more natural usually to put the scalar in front. It's just equivalent. So I could have written this the other way around, if you don't mind, I don't want to. I'll put it the other way around, there. And here we have again our Laplacian. You see, this is Laplacian H. Now, I've illustrated these points only for you to practice, I mean, to get used to the way of handling these different things. We're not going to use them for quite a while, but I just wanted to illustrate the power of the algebraic rules when applied to these things, that you can understand all these complicated things which I've written on the blackboard, with the exception of the meanings of the quantities, by just the formal rules that this operation is equivalent to differentiation. There are, however, two pitfalls which I would like to exhibit, neither of which will we get involved with in this course. But they're there, and the following is the one. Suppose that I were to take gradient psi cross gradient phi. Then you see, if I took phi and psi are two scalars, and I take gradient phi, that's a vector, gradient psi, that's a vector. Then you say, oh, look, gradient cross gradient is zero, because A cross A is zero when A is the same vector as itself. Now, the point is, although the operators are the same, these two gradients are really different because they do different things. This is the differentiates of phi, and this thing is an operator which differentiates of psi. So if the things differentiate different things, of course, they're not identical anymore. And it's no longer true that this grad is exactly the same as that grad, and it's exactly the same as if you put A cross A somewhere. So that's one thing to worry about, but we won't have any particular examples where we'll worry about that. I looked over all the things right we're going to write down. We never get involved with that, but it is a problem that you have to realize that if the gradient happens not to operate on the same thing, then it's not identical. If, on the other hand, I write without the psi here, then ultimately, when the differentiations occur, this gradient will operate on the phi. So this gradient also operates on the phi, exactly the same. And then it is zero because this is A cross A, exactly the same. That's one pitfall. Pitfall number two, which again we won't get into, and that's the following. The rules that I've outlined here are ideal and simple and nice in the case of rectangular coordinates. For example, it's true that if you have Laplacian H and ask for the x component of that, that the answer is the second derivative with respect to x of h sub x plus the second derivative with respect to y plus the second derivative with respect to z, all of h sub x, as you would expect, being that the x component of the scalar times h. However, it's not true if you ask for the radial component of h. If you try to take the Laplacian of the radial component, it isn't this combination on the radial component. And the reason is the following. When we're dealing with algebra of vectors, we have them all on the same point. But when we're dealing with derivatives of vectors, we have vectors at different places. Now, if you're an idiot enough to take a different coordinate system to represent the behavior of the vector at this point, then you take at this point, then you're going to get in a lot of trouble when you start to differentiate the components. You see, for instance, if we take what you call the radial component, then at this point we're taking a component in this direction, and at this point we're taking a component in that direction. So we're taking components in different directions, and as we differentiate, we're also rotating the coordinate system. And so all the formulas get much more complicated, and we won't discuss them at all. Because it's not necessary. And I have never in my life used the formulas for any of these things when they're in curved coordinate systems, with the following exception. That the formula for this thing can be written, because it's a scalar. This operator can be written in any coordinate system you want. And this formula is still true, even if this is written in polar coordinates, provided that the component of which you differentiate is always x, y, or z, or rectangular. In other words, it has to do with this, that we would like to refer our vectors always to a coordinate system which is fixed and doesn't vary as you move around in space. The components of the vectors, then the formulas are all correct. And now I would like one more point to make. I would like to interpret, I haven't much time, but we'll continue the subject next time. But I'd like to interpret at least one of these, and I'll interpret this one. What is the physical meaning of the divergence? And the answer is this. We look at it and we try to get an example to try to understand it. Well, I'll tell you it's probably faster to just tell you what the interpretation is. Suppose first that we only have a vector which has a vector only with an x component, just for a moment. Then the divergence is the rate of change of the x component with respect to x. In other words, there's a flow here in the x direction that's stronger, say, than the flow back here, where this distance is delta x. Then the difference of these two flows is dhx dx. But hx is the flow through a surface. And so if I put the surface area here, this is the x-axis, and then this is a little plane in the yz with height delta y and depth delta z. Then the flow through this surface here is h of x at x plus delta x, and y and z, more or less y and z, multiplied by delta y delta z. And the flow through the plane back here is different. What I'm going to calculate, I might as well give in and tell you what it is. I'm going to calculate the total flux of heat out of this volume, the cube, a very small cube. How much is the total flux of heat out of the cube? The flux out of this face here is the x component of h times delta y delta z, of course calculated a little different place than the flux out of, the flux in, on the other hand, is minus x at x at y and z times delta y delta z. You see, the difference in the flux, the net flux out, net flow out, in this example, would be the difference of these, which is dh sub x dx, because it only changes with delta x, times delta x, delta y, delta z. How cute. Because this is the delta of the volume. So the net flow out of an infinitesimal volume, in the one case here, is dh sub x dx times the infinitesimal volume. What about the other two things? Well, wait, h really may have more components. And you see that there's flows in the bottom and top surface, and flows in the front and back surface that all have to be added together to get the total flow out of the volume. Well, of course, we leave to your imagination the demonstration that the flow from the y direction and that flow is dh sub y dy times the delta volume, and that the z direction is dh sub z dz. And so the total, the divergence of h is the flow of h out of a unit volume. We'll continue this next time. Thank you.
A little bit heavy, but I think it's all right. I think a lot of the kids do this stuff.
You have to just practice with this.
You've got to practice, right.
I gave them some practice examples.
If you came to the conclusion that you should start from this end of things.
Yeah, I did after further
level.
Oh, did I not tell you? I went down and talked to you about this. Oh, you saw me come in, you were busy with somebody. I went out again.
Yeah.
I didn't talk to you. I wanted to tell you I decided to do it.
I think it's perfectly good at first,
Perfect.
But you won't find it.
It
doesn't make any difference, so, except that they're very old. 14th. Well, they're not very different than the last few editions, so. 14th, yeah. 14th is what I own. They don't even mark them edition numbers anymore. They just keep revising it continuously.
I used to sell them.
What?
Last summer.
What number?
62
now. What edition? 15th, 16th now. The 1962 encyclopedia, see? They don't even give a new edition. They don't give it by edition numbers anymore because they don't revamp the whole thing at once like they used to. They just keep modifying it each year. This article or that article.
Right.
So therefore, any editions are...
Given edition.
Perhaps you're right. I don't think so. Hello, we're going to have lunch, all right?
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Could you explain that again?
Yeah, next time.
Okay.
I didn't give myself enough time.
Wow. 4 pages of notes.
It's all in the summary. It's all in the summary.
Yeah, I know. And it's also all in the summary because I haven't cut back in the roof yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, this stuff up here, that should be well known. Is that, was that, got that memorized? I suppose everybody has that stuff memorized.
At least at their fingertips.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Well, then this has to become at the fingertips, and the rest of the stuff will be easy. It gets easier from here on. I made it this way that the first few lectures will be the hardest when everybody's paying attention. And then it'll get easier. So you get all the machinery at the beginning, you see.